The Voice of Reason Broadcast Network presents The Orthodox Nationalist. Dr. Matthew Raphael Johnson is a former professor, a professional writer, and a priest of the Ukrainian Orthodox Church. His website is russjournal.com. That's russjournal.com. Now here's your host, Matt Johnson.
Okay, everybody, welcome to yet another edition of The Orthodox Medievalist. Today, we will be discussing something extremely important historically, and in particular, something of central importance to the country of Ukraine. And that is the rebellion of the Cossack Hetman, Bogdan Khmelnytsky. And this rebellion is to Ukraine very much what the Revolutionary War was to the United States. It's just that central. We're talking about at this point in history, we're talking about a Ukraine that is deeply divided, centered around the Dnieper River. The middle and upper regions are under the Polish oligarchy. And Kiev itself is at the center, right at the middle part of the Dnieper. Now, in the early 1600s, most of the Cossack units that had existed, generally speaking, supported Poland. But in the early 1600s, a lot began to change in this regard. In the early 1600s, the Polish government, which we've spoken about quite a bit on this show, sought to integrate itself. It sought to create an integral empire based around several pillars. The first is serfdom. The second is the Catholic Church, which includes the Uniates, which we've also spoken of on this show. And thirdly, that in order to promote this level of integration, that taxes needed to be assessed at higher and higher levels. So as the early 1600s wear on, there is a growing spirit of dissatisfaction and rebellion. Also at this period of time, most Ukrainians, regardless of their social status, begin looking to Russia for protection, for an alternative to their condition. Something else happens. The printing press is imported into Ukraine at this very same time. That is an amazing confluence of events that just precisely as all of this kind of dissatisfaction is developing, the printing press makes its debut on Ukrainian territory. As an aside, there's quite a bit of travel. You know, Poland is very much a part of the West, as we all know. Poland at the time was right, you know, smack in the middle of the Renaissance. She was not a backwater by any stretch of the imagination. So you had a lot of travelers going through Poland, Ukraine, Russia at the time, and there are so many travel logs, so many reports making it very clear that Ukrainians, Poles, and Russians are three totally different people. You know, I used to hold the opinion, and I want to make a formal retraction right here and right now. You know, I used to be one of these guys to think that there is just this one Russian population. There are great Russians, and there's northern Russians, and there's eastern Russians, and there's Ukrainians, and there's Belarusians, and they're all over the place. That's not the case. That's not the case in terms of history, ideology. It's not even the case in terms of basic ethnicity. And one of the proofs we have of this, I mean, aside from all of the historical material, is that you have a lot of travel logs being written this period of time where it's very clear that Ukrainians and Russians are being treated as two totally different people with two very different kinds of biases. What the Cossacks were doing at the end of the 1500s and the beginning of the 1600s, they are, in essence, well, they do a few things. They generally support themselves by raiding Turkish caravans and ships in order to free Christian slaves. And the Cossacks had always maintained that it's not really the Turks that controlled that slave trade, but Jews working for the Turks. And so any time that the Cossacks would raid a Turkish slave caravan, whether it be on land or on sea, they would slaughter all the Jews and take all of the Orthodox captives back to their homes. So that's the first thing that they do. The second thing that they do is that they are the guardians of the river towns. The river towns, these depots of trade, legitimate trade, of course, on the Dnieper River and elsewhere. But, you know, in this period of time, we're talking about the beginning of the 1600s now, it's not an accident that the Cossack forces throughout Ukraine and Poland are increasing to a great extent. They're increasing as a response not only to Polish integration, but they're also increasing in response to Russia, slowly but surely stretching out its southern border and imposing serfdom wherever it goes. Therefore, the two great serf-owning powers, that of Poland and Russia, are expanding, they are consolidating, they are integrating. The Cossacks then form a body that is willing to accept runaway serfs, people who cannot take this kind of lifestyle. So it's no surprise. It's no surprise that at the beginning of the 1600s, the Cossack forces are growing in numbers substantially. So what begins to happen at this same period of time is that Poland and Russia begin to cooperate on one particular issue. How do we control the Cossack units? We can't have the Cossack units in existence because they are a magnet for all of these people who don't want to be serfs, who don't want to live under these oligarchic powers. Now, they realize, of course, that militarily speaking, the Cossacks are invincible. We all know that at the time, that is simply the case. No one could defeat them. So Plan B, both in Krakow, the capital of Poland at the time, and in Moscow, Plan B is to what we call in the literature to register them, to create a registry of Cossacks, which is another way of saying this registry is essentially an employment contract between a Cossack unit and the government that is sponsoring them. Now, as the economies of Poland and Russia are growing at this period of time, and they are growing substantially, especially in the grain trade to feed the growing Western European populations, both governments are worried about labor, and their strongest and most devoted, in terms of, you know, hard work, the most hardworking laborers running away from the farms to join the Cossacks, to go Cossacking, as it used to be called. And so both governments are really worried about this. Not only do you have a series of decentralized Cossack units throughout the southern part of the Slavic world, right on the border of the Turkish world, who are causing trouble for all governments involved, because, you know, frankly, Cossacks are anarchists. They are national Christian anarchists, and they want nothing to do with the state. So these governments, and I guess I'll include Turkey within these governments. These three governments could not have the Cossacks functioning because they are a drain on manpower. They are an ideological counterweight to serfdom and to centralization, whether it be oligarchic or royal centralization. And of course, they are a military force that no one can seem to be able to defeat. Now, as these governments begin registering Cossacks as, tamed units to be used to fight each other's enemies and to act as policemen, a group of resistors, the non-registrants, will go to the rapids of the Dnieper, and they will form what is called the Sich, or the Zaporozhian Sich, the fortress which becomes the capital of all Cossackdom, which is to be found only on the islands of the rapids of the southern Dnieper. In other words, no one can really get to them unless you're a Cossack. So these are islands in the southern Dnieper in the midst of the rapids. Very difficult to get to this to these people. This is where the rebels go. Those who refuse to register with governments, and they become the Zaporozhian Sich. Sich is just another name for fortress or a militant organization. They become the rebels of the rebels. What do we know about the Zaporozhian Sich? We know, number one, that they are always moving. They are constantly in motion so that no one can pin them down. We know that it was a males-only society, that men needed to bond with other men in this martial environment. We know that they lived a Spartan life. They lived with the minimum of conveniences. But one of their big enemies was the Jewish population. And one of the things that they would do is that every once in a while, they would go out to the bars and taverns of Ukraine and Poland, almost exclusively owned by Jews, or I really should say the descendants of the Khazars, and they will tax them. They will say, you have made your money on getting our people drunk and stupid, and therefore we're going to take a quarter of your earnings and bring it back to the sick. The Jews were the number one enemy of the Cossack force, not only because of their involvement in slavery, but their involvement with alcohol. Not drinking it themselves, but making sure to profit in selling it to the Goyim. The Cossack forces, generally speaking, were divided up into regiments. These regiments were headquartered in towns, and each town had its own colonel. And in general, you have, according to Polish estimates at the time, roughly four or five of these regiments, roughly maybe 600 fighting men in each regiment. The highest power in the Cossack world is the assembly. The assembly of all males who are capable of bearing arms. At the local level, the Cossack units were organized according to meetings of the elders, those who have a long history of fighting and have survived. I strongly recommend to my readers that they read a very good book, a work of historical fiction by the great Ukrainian writer Gogol, called Taras Bulba. And this will give some general outline to the nature of Cossack organization. So, and then, of course, these meetings, these local meetings of the elders, And when I say elder, I'm referring to those who have a long history of going on campaign, of fighting, of freeing slaves, of escaping torture. And as an aside, by the way, the Cossacks, of course, were strictly Orthodox. They were, for the most part, Slav, but they did have Turks and Persians among their number. The only thing that they required was that you be an Orthodox Christian person. These elders formed what we would call the general staff of the military organization of the Cossack units. I want to mention too, also as another aside, there is a very good travelogue out there somewhere. I saw it years ago and I forgot about it. There's a Frenchman by the name of Bupin. Who lived among the Cossacks at the Zaporozhian host for 17 years. And here's what he said about them. I'm not going to quote him, but there are three major points he made about the Cossack forces. Number one, they love freedom more than they love life. Death is preferable to slavery. Number two, they don't care about money. When these guys went and would take money from the Jewish tavern keepers, you know what they would do? They'd go to a Turkish slave caravan, and then they would buy all of these Orthodox slaves from, you know, Ukraine and Russia, and then send them back home, especially the women, because they knew that the women were just going to be raped until they were too old to be attractive. You know, and the Khazars were a part of this movement. Although he has one negative thing to say. He says that they're a hard group of people to trust. And he says that, you know, not necessarily as an insult. He says it in such a way that, you know, because of their position in society at the time, they only trust sworn brethren of the Cossack host. And because this guy is French, they were kind of iffy about him. So, anyway, as an aside, I mean, that's just one travelogue written by somebody who lived with these guys for 17 years. And he says, basically, they are nothing but heroes. Heroes against serfdom. Heroes against slavery. Heroes against the Jewish domination of society that the Polish government permitted in the 16th and 17th century. But as I said before, now you have two groups of Cossacks. You have one group of Cossacks that are willing to be registered by the Polish and Russian governments, and then you have those who are not willing to be registered. And so fights will occasionally break out between the two groups. Now, needless to say, the peasants who worked on either Russian or Polish farms supported the Cossack movement, as did especially your lower clergy. The Cossacks were a religious group, and I actually, as I meant to say before and forgot to say, you know, when a Cossack was captured and he was being tortured as to, you know, where the rest of his men were, all Cossack men were had to learn the Psalms from scriptures by heart. That was one, particularly of the older Cossacks, that was a requirement. They had to learn the Psalms by heart, and so as they were being tortured, they would then recite Psalm 1 through Psalm 150 to themselves. So that should tell you something a little bit about the nature of these people and what kind of knighthood. And you know, the Zaporozhian group referred to themselves explicitly as knights. This is not a metaphor here. They view themselves as knights for liberty, for Jesus Christ, for liberation from the yoke of the state. So, as a matter of course, the Cossacks, wherever they might be, resisted this concept that was coming from Krakow and Moscow of regularization, to register them, to make them regular military formations. We are not regular military formations. In fact, one of the things that makes us what we are and as powerful and as strong as we are is that we are not regular formations. But the beginning of the 1600s, the big enemy was Poland. Polish serfdom was harsher than Russian serfdom. And so you had different committees of local elders who kind of debated, what do we do here? Do we ally with the Turks? Which, by the way, surprisingly enough, was a common option. Or do we ally with the Russians and maybe even the Lithuanians? Does that even make sense in this case? Both Sweden and Poland paid off the Turkish government to make regular raids on the Cossack forces. We're going to see later on that we can't get to it today, but the next time we're going to talk about another great leader, Mazepa. The Swedes and Mazepa teamed up against Russia, Peter the Great. But Sweden and Poland were paying a lot of money to make certain that the Turks kept the Cossacks busy militarily. And there's something else, too. The Genoese, the Commercial Republic of Genoa, is working with the Turks, the Tartars, and the Khazars to protect the slave trade on the Black Sea. The Khazars, the Tartars, the Genoese, and Italy, these are all conspiring to essentially empty Ukraine of its beautiful women. And you see this right now in the Jewish-controlled slave trade coming out of Ukraine. Ukraine always seems to be the target here. But Ukraine is the primary source of the slaves, whether it be of the Genoese, of Venice, of Turkey, even of Persia. And Ukrainian women, Ukrainian women are this beautiful mixture of the Mediterranean and the Nordic. It is a beautiful women. Ukrainian women are extraordinary. I've always said that the cure for the disease of homosexuality is to expose the queers to as many Ukrainian women as possible. That mixture of Mediterranean and Nordic is extraordinary. Absolutely extraordinary. As a result of that, Ukraine becomes a major target of the slave traders. And the Cossacks find themselves constantly at war with this alliance of the Jew Khazar, of the Tartar, of the Genoese Italian, within the Black Sea region. Okay. All right, that's our sort of introduction for now. That's the nature and struggle of the Cossack movement. When we get back, we will talk about Bogdan Khmelnytsky himself, the leader of the most massive Cossack Ukrainian rebellion of all times that could have, but did not, redraw the map of Europe. So hang in there, friends. We'll be right back.
Don't go away, because there's more to come on the Orthodox Nationalist. You're listening to the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network. Visit us at reasonradionetwork.com. return to the Orthodox Nationalist, brought to you by the Voice of Reason Broadcast Network, reasonradionetwork.com.
Welcome back, my friends. God bless. We've been talking about the Cossacks, and we've been talking about the those things which led up to what we're going to talk about right now, the massive Cossack uprising of Bogdan Khmelnytsky. Bogdan Khmelnytsky, like a lot of the Cossack leaders, is a Ukrainian man born in the Polish Empire. For a long time, he is very pro-Polish. But two things happened. In the very late 1600s, a Polish oligarch stole his wife, seduced her with his money, and then went on to murder his son. In a rage, Khmelnytsky's son. Remember, Khmelnytsky, although a subject of the Polish Empire, is Orthodox and therefore is a second-class citizen. He went to the Polish government saying, number one, my wife has been stolen, essentially raped and abducted by this Polish nobleman, and has killed my son in the process. The Polish government tells him to go to hell. You are a Ukrainian scumbag, and you are Orthodox, and you are demonic, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Excuse me, I misspoke. I apologize. It's 1647, not 1697. I apologize. The fact is that the Polish government, refuses to punish this guy. And we've talked about the Polish constitution before, how corrupt it was, but this is normal. If you were a member of the Polish aristocracy or oligarchy, you did precisely what you pleased. Bogdan Khmelnytsky, who, you know, in essence was a nobleman himself, but given that he was Orthodox, had no political rights, and was a Cossack on top of it, used this as that catalyst, the final straw, to launch the 1647 rebellion against the Polish government. And I'm telling you, this rebellion could have completely redrawn the map of Europe. We'll talk about why it didn't. But the rebellion against Poland is launched that same year. Khmelnytsky is a man of tremendous rationality and self-control. He refuses to get angry. He wants to think rationally. What he demands is the rights of the Cossack peoples living on Polish territory, and of course, the rights of the Orthodox Church, to which he belongs. The beginning of the rebellion shows a humiliating series of defeats on the Polish army. Now, I've got to mention that the Polish army wasn't really an army in our sense of the word. Because Poland was really an oligarchy, it was up to the local aristocrats to raise forces to fight in various battles. So you never really had this kind of a centralized strategy like you had in Russia. You know, like you had in France, like you had in other places where you had some kind of a central government. There was no real strong central government in general in Krakow. Now, the funny thing is that the Polish government tried to use Cossack auxiliaries that had been registered with the Polish government to fight Khmelnytsky, but needless to say, these auxiliaries immediately cut and ran, saying, we will not fight Khmelnytsky, because the fact is, the man is in the right. Wherever the Poles had taken over, within their holdings, the very beginning of this rebellion, 1647, the fact is that they began to execute anybody who was remotely considered pro-Cossack. So the Poles, and again, this isn't so much the Polish government in Krakow. This is the domination of the Polish oligarchy, aristocracy. So now you had a reign of terror. Khmelnytsky has launched his rebellion. He's defeated every Polish army sent against him. The Cossacks that were used by Poland have deserted and have went to Khmelnytsky, or at the very least, ran to Russia. In frustration and anger, the rich in Poland begin to murder men, women, and children who they might think are somewhat associated with the Cossack movement. The king of Poland at the time was Władysław IV, and he had sent the main Polish army, the elite of the Polish army, the same year against Khmelnytsky, and it was annihilated very soon after King Władysław IV was dead. Poland didn't exist anymore. So, the fact is that you have the king dead. You have the most militant of the oligarchy in a lot of military trouble. You have no substantial military forces at the moment of any note whatsoever. What does Khmelnytsky do? He could have ravaged the whole country and made this great Ukrainian state. He did not. He was a Christian man. He was a man of mercy. He said, I will not do that. I will not behave the way the Poles have behaved to us. I will enter into negotiations with what is left of the Polish government in specifically in June of 1648. And the Cossack units throughout Russia and Ukraine are debating substantially as to what to do with this corpse. I mean, look, within a few months, Poland has gone from a huge Central European empire to nothing, to a joke, to a void, to a handful of oligarchs who are living in caves, petrified that a Cossack might find them and slit their throat. But at the same time, these same Polish oligarchs, whether they were going to win or lose, refused to compromise. They didn't care if they were going to die. They didn't care. They told Khmelnytsky to go to hell. You are a barbarian. You are a savage. You are beneath us. And we will do whatever it takes to defeat you. So what happens? The Tartars, the descendants of the Mongols living in places like the Crimea and the Black Sea, decide that maybe they too want a piece of the Polish corpse. And they join with Khmelnytsky. But by now, you know, the man is a legend. People are talking about him in Great Britain. They're talking about him in France. They're talking about Khmelnytsky in Spain. No one has done this before. The man is an international celebrity within a few months. What was left of the Polish army was annihilated by Khmelnytsky's forces and the Tartar allies that had come to support the Cossack cause against Poland. The Cossacks demand that the Jews of the Polish Empire be expelled. Why single them out? You know, there are all kinds of minorities living in the Polish Empire at this time, middle of the 17th century, including minorities, you know, that have done well financially. You have Armenians, you have Arabs, you have Turks, you have Germans, you have Balts, you have descendants from the Turkish tribes of Central Asia, all of whom have relatively small but, you know, fairly stable communities within the Polish Empire. Why is it only the Jews that the Cossacks demand be removed? What was so special about them? Why not the Armenians? Why not the Germans? Why not anybody else? The fact is that the Ukrainian Cossack population and the peasants that supported them viewed the Jews not just as a force of exploitation, but as a force of immorality. But what made matters worse is that the Cossacks made the claim, as Poland is totally on its back, that the Jews and the Jesuit order are in fact working together to assault, to humiliate, and to destroy the Orthodox population of Ukraine. So it's not the, so there's not just the Jews that they want expelled. It is the Jesuits that they want expelled. And the fact is that the wording of the literature at the time is that the Cossacks are saying that the Jews and the Jesuits are working together as one unit. What was left of the Polish oligarchy told Khmelnytsky, even as they were essentially, with their head in the noose, in their pride, in their stupidity, told Khmelnytsky to go to hell. The Jesuits and the Jews joined forces, and the Jesuits made it clear, both in Poland as well as to the Pope of Rome, that the Jews are our friends and they will not be kicked out of the country no matter what. The Polish nobles will reject all the demands of the Cossack insurgency even when they are barely functional militarily. Well, what are their options? They have no substantial military force. They have zero public support. The fact of the matter is that as far as the Polish Empire at this time is concerned, what's going on is that you only have three groups. You have the Polish oligarchy, you have the Jews, and you have the Jesuits. Those are the only three functional pillars of the Polish government and society. As it becomes clear that Khmelnytsky has won and defeated all of his opponents. There's only one option. These three forces will then go to Germany. They'll pawn their last diamond, they'll pawn their last anything, slave girl, whatever it is, to get an army of Germans to attack the Cossacks. And that's exactly what happened in 1651. The attacks of the Germans will raise the morale of a new Polish army that the Jesuits and the oligarchy will raise in the early part of the 1650s. And Khmelnytsky, not realizing this is going on, finds himself being hit from all sides. The Tartars and the Turks, who at one time were the allies of Khmelnytsky, say, this isn't worth it anymore, we're taking off. Finally, for the first time, the Cossacks are defeated in open battle. And at the town of Bila Tsarskoe in 1651, new negotiations are entered into. The negotiations went very badly. The only thing that the Polish nobles wanted, now that they have won their victory with German mercenaries, the only thing they said to the Cossacks, other than go to hell, is send the serfs back to the land to work for us, because that's all they ever cared about. Khmelnytsky, having faced his first military defeat, began considering an alliance with the Tsar of Moscow, who at the time was a Tsar Alexis. Now, there were others who viewed Turkey as a better ally than Russia. There were some Cossacks, usually younger Cossacks, who viewed Turkey as more trustworthy. The older, more religious Cossacks viewed Moscow as more worthy because they were Orthodox people and they could be counted on to help the Cossack cause. So, but it was decided, Khmelnytsky decided that he was going to go to Russia. The assembly under the a very good man, Tsar Alexis, the Boyar Duma, initially rejected the alliance with the Cossacks. The Swedes were all in favor of it. They were quite willing to cooperate, and this is, you know, probably a topic for a different conversation, but the Patriarch of the Russian Church, Nikon, he wanted a close connection between Ukraine and Russia. It's almost as if, you know, the Swedes really preferred a Ukrainian alliance to a Polish alliance. And this is going to come up again and when we talk about Ivan Mazepa and that rebellion. But here's the thing. You know, Bogdan Khmelnytsky was a devout Orthodox person. He took his sufferings as, you know, a gift from God, a way to make him a leader. He rejected the Turkish alliance partially on religious grounds, partially on the grounds that the Turks were heavily involved in the slave trade. But here was the other problem. Tsar Alexis says, I am the autocrat of all Russia. I am the leader of all Orthodoxy. Remember, by now, Constantinople, Antioch, Alexandria, these were all under Islamic control. Alexis refused to promise anything to Khmelnytsky. I don't promise anything. I am above those kind of contractual because a contractual relationship assumes that the two parties are equal. I am not an equal. This is a huge mistake on Alexis's part. He refused to make any promises to inferiors like Khmelnytsky. What a massive, absurd mistake Alexis made, and I believe personally that he did this at the advice of the Patriarch Nikon. In 1654, Alexis gave his word. Tsar Alexis gave his word. And nothing in writing, nothing formal, but Tsar Alexis gave his word that he would protect Ukraine from the Turks or the Poles or whoever. No other guarantees were made. Now, Russian negotiators who were sent from Moscow made promises in Alexis's name. But Alexis never actually personally made those promises. This is something that a lot of even, you know, very good Ukrainian historians don't get. Alexis did not make these promises. The negotiators sent from Moscow said that Alexis made these promises. So here's what was eventually signed. In 1654, the infamous Treaty of Pereslavl was signed. And it has seven specific items. Number one, all local officials in Ukraine will be elected locally. Number two, the urban military, those Cossack forces located in towns, will be paid by Moscow. Number three, the hetman can only receive envoys and ambassadors from states that are friendly to Moscow. Number four, the Ukrainian clergy will remain where they are, and Moscow will not interfere with their functioning. Number five, the Tsar will protect the Cossacks from Turkey and Poland, but any other military action against any other power must come from Moscow. Number six, that the Cossacks could keep their own law code. And number seven, the hetman will be the head of the Cossack forces will be chosen locally, and that there will be a registry of Cossacks, but that will be a very large registry of 60,000. Now, that treaty has become a source of contention between the two countries for a very long time. Ultimately, every one of those promises were violated, not by Alexis, but by Peter the Great, and then finally by Catherine the Second, who was an evil woman, Catherine the Second, who will destroy the Ukrainian Cossack host and bring it under regular Russian military, the regular Russian apparatus. So that is the rebellion of Khmelnytsky, and that is a rebellion that, you know, had Khmelnytsky pushed his advantage and taken all of Poland, you would have had a Europe where Ukraine would have taken the place of the later Austro-Hungarian Empire. That's how severe the map of Europe would have been redrawn. But Khmelnytsky, he was not about revenge. He was about justice. And I say to you that he is a hero. He is a man to emulate. And he is a true Orthodox struggler. He is a man who suffered. He is a man who suffered worse than we have suffered. And we need to read about him. We need to immortalize him. We need to tell the truth about him. So I want to thank all of my listeners and Voice of Reason. I want to thank Dietrich and Steve and Mike, as I always do. I want to thank my my listeners, friends as well as enemies. I appreciate you both, and I love you both, because, you know, to have enemies is a good thing. It keeps you honest. It keeps you on the straight and narrow. So I want to wish you all the blessings of our Lord Jesus Christ, and we will continue this next time, because we will talk about another Ukrainian hero, Ivan Mazepa, who will come into existence and become a hero under the reign of Peter the Great of Russia. So we are not done with this topic, and so I want to thank you again, and I also want to remind you, by the way, I never really get a chance to check the blog on VOR. I'm not ignoring you people. If you have a problem with me, or if you have a compliment or a question, go to my email address, FatherRaphael@yahoo.com. It's on the thing somewhere on the website. Do that instead of commenting on the regular board, because you know what? The internet is nothing but a source of temptation, quite frankly. And I want to stay off it as much as possible. So to my friends as well as to my enemies, I want to say thank you and God bless.
Thanks for listening. The Orthodox Nationalist returns Thursday evening, 9 to 10 p.m. Eastern U.S. time. Join us at ReasonRadioNetwork.com.